You are tuned to KBBI AM 890 Homer. I'm your host, Aaron Bolton, and you are listening to The Coffee Table. And today we are talking about invasive plants and animals. And in the studio, I'm joined by Matt Steffi with Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, Jen Hester with the Kenai Watershed Forum, and Janice Chumley with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service. Thanks to all you guys for joining me. And I just want to start with a little bit more on introductions for all three of you. So if you want to maybe start with you, Matt, if you want to explain who you work with and kind of what your relation to invasive plants or animals is.
Excellent. Thank you. Yeah, since 2013, I've been with the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District as a natural resource specialist, working in a variety of the different resource programs we do. And one of the primary ones has been invasive species management and focusing primarily on terrestrial plants and some freshwater aquatics. And have recently joined staff with the City of Homer as a Parks Maintenance Coordinator. And so the invasive plants we have within the City of Homer are primarily in our parks and right-of-ways.
Okay. And go ahead.
Hi, my name's Jen, and I work for the Kenai Watershed Forum.
Okay.
And my role really is mostly on freshwater aquatic invasives, that being northern pike, Elodia, reed canary grass, and also white sweet clover.
And I am Janice Chumley, and I work for the Cooperative Extension Service. I'm the Integrated Pest Management Technician for the entire Kenai Peninsula, and invasive plants have been part of the UAF Extension Program for 20 years now, and a lot of it is to educate people on how to control them and to keep them out once they've been noted, that early detection, rapid response.
Okay, great. And, you know, I wanted to start with kind of defining what is an invasive. You know, there are plenty of non-native plants that people have brought here that plant, you know, plant them. And so what, you know, for any one of you that wants to take the question, what exactly makes something invasive, whether it's a plant or even an animal?
I'm just going to say carrots are never invasive.
That's a very good cover statement. If we want to get technical, I believe it's Presidential Executive Order 11032, signed in 1999, that defines an invasive species as a non-native species that causes economic or ecological harm or harm to human health. So just because it's not native doesn't mean it's bad, and just because it's annoying or weedy doesn't mean it's bad, but if it causes harm that's economic, ecological, or to human health, it's considered invasive.
Okay, and that goes to say for both plants or animals. I mean, is
plants,
there,
animals, insects, fungus, any of it is considered invasive in that category.
Okay, and you know, as far as what are the main modes for transportation for, I guess, both non-native and invasive plants to get here, just outside of humans deliberately planting something?
Well, I don't believe that most people are deliberate in their actions, except perhaps some pike plants, but I do think that a lot of things arrive just through transportation. You know, we bring a lot of landscape materials into the state and onto the peninsula. In those landscape materials, perhaps there are seeds from unwanted plants that show up. They kind of hitchhike with that. Same thing can happen with slug eggs or insects that haven't been established here before. So that's not intentional. That is just part of commerce, and I think that that happens fairly frequently. Jen, I think that you could probably say how Elodia got here.
We think mostly the vector is via float planes. We see it being tangled up on the rudders as the float planes are taxing. And so both when there's an infested lake, then it gives rise to all the planes in that area being able to transport it to other areas. And that's really the main vector we're seeing on the Kenai Peninsula and throughout the state of Alaska.
Okay, and can you explain what Elodia is?
Elodia is a weedy, non-native, submersed aquatic plant. It's common in the aquarium trade, and that might have been initially how it first got here, is via aquarium dumps. I think sometimes we don't realize that what we love, let's say you have a fish in an aquarium and you have some plants in there, some fish in there, and you don't want it to die because you loved it and you are done with it and you release it into the wild, that's going to cause harm. And we see that throughout all of really the world, that those issues of releasing pets into the wild are causing harm. And so that might have been the first initial way that Elodia got established here, and then from there it really took off.
Okay, and you know, in Elodia, the seemingly the concern with that is oxygen levels and spawning ground for fish and lakes. Is that kind of a concern with
that's
that?
Correct, as well as recreational. Is it harmful for recreational things as far as like boat rudders and the trailers, as well as residential property values will decrease because of how weedy it is.
Okay, and you know, and we mentioned Elodia, but what are some, as far as the Kenai Peninsula is concerned, I mean, what are our largest concerns with invasives? I mean, both plant and animal fungus. I mean, what invasives are here, and what are the largest concerns?
Well, there's a number of invasives here. 127 of them identified through ECHAPIC, I think, somewhere around in there on the Kenai Peninsula. One of the big issues is prioritizing where our efforts are going to be applied. And that has to do with whether you have a discrete or continuous population and how big it is. And so I know for the Kenai Peninsula, the Cooperative Weed Management Area members, for several years now, we've really focused a lot of our efforts on reed canary grass, bird vetch, and white sweet clover, because those are ones that they're small enough in population we can get rid of them, and they're highly ranked invasives, so we need to get rid of them. Reed canary grass being the one potential exception, because in some places it's there to stay, but it's spatially limited to watersheds. So there's certain watersheds that are still very pristine and we need to protect them. There's other watersheds such as the Anchor River that are fairly carpeted with reed canary grass and I can apply some effort. So
okay, and you mentioned some of the organizations that are working towards dealing with some of these invasives. If you want to explain kind of what are some of the organizations that exist here on the peninsula, and what are they doing to handle invasives here?
Yeah, actually, so there's a lot of individual organizations like the Cooperative Extension Service, the Watershed Forum, Soil and Water Conservation Districts, various tribal entities that have various programs they're doing. What's great is that it all combines into what's called the Cooperative Weed Management Area. And that's an organizational model that is nationwide. You'll find them all over the country. And what it is it's a vehicle for federal, state, municipal, native, private entities, organizations to all get together and basically recognize the fact that invasive infestations do not respect property lines. And so if you're going to treat on your own property, you better be partnering with your neighbor and your community to treat the entire infestation, and that requires collaboration. You can't effectively treat invasives without collaboration. So it combines funding, it combines resources, staff, it combines all kinds of stuff, and Elodia is a great example for that. We never would have been as successful as we was if it wasn't for such a massive level of cooperation. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like GoBots. We've all got our specialties and what we go for, but then we all unite and get together and make some massive monster of invasive management.
Sure. And you know, I just want to remind listeners, if you have a question about invasives, both on, you know, public land on the peninsula or even in your own backyard, you can call 235-7721 with your questions. You can also email info@kbbi.org. Please include your name if you are emailing your question in so we can know who is asking that question. And so, you know, just talking about some of these efforts, and there's, you know, there's all these individual efforts, but I assume funding is a huge hurdle to manage some of these issues. And if you want to kind of talk a little bit about how expensive it is to actually battle invasive species.
Wow. Good question.
Yeah. Very, very. Depends on who your partners are.
And so if we want to, like, defer to, you know, the larger group that combines all the agencies on the peninsula, I mean, how does that all work? Do agencies funnel money into that and then the larger efforts take place? Or how do the funding mechanisms actually work? And kind of maybe if you want to give an example, maybe for Elodia or maybe even Northern Pike, if you have familiarity with that.
Yeah, so there's two different types of CWMAs across the nation. Some are like ours, which are loose entities, and then there's some like the Anchorage CWMA, which is actually a 501c3, and so it can actually be a vessel for money, it can hold money. Our CWMA does not have a bank account, but our partners within it do. So one example would be when we had the Elodia crisis and it was first identified in the three main lakes in North Kenai. One of our partners, which is the Kenai Peninsula Borough, gave the CWMA essentially $440,000 to spend on herbicide. And the way they did that was that they held onto the money when it was time to buy it. They ordered it. They had it shipped to the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, they were the ones who held on to it. And then when it was time for application, many of us went out there, all of us under a different funding source, all of us being funded by a different grant to work on the same project. So it can get really complicated sometimes and requires some very resourceful connection of different funding sources. But that would be an example of a good way that a strong partner was able to help out.
And Janice, it looked like you had something to add to that, or did he basically kind of...
Oh, Matt is so... He's so eloquent. I just love how he explains things. It makes working with him really pleasant.
And, you know, so I understand it's a little bit complicated, but are we talking in the thousands, millions of dollars to handle a particular invasive? I'm sure it varies depending on what it is. But
just for perspective, across the United States, all states have problems with invasives, and they spend individually and federally millions and millions of dollars on just control. Alaska is fairly new to this game. A colleague of mine who originally started this, Jamie Snyder, she said Alaska is the last chance to get it right. And because we do have fairly small populations of invasive plants, there's been a lot of resistance to trying to control them or eradicate them due to the fact that people really don't like to use herbicides. And I can understand that, but it's a very difficult thing to do just by, you know, getting a group of volunteers to hand pull something. So it does require that cooperative addressing in order to look at it, and it does require money. Even if you decide not to use an herbicide in some situations, you will still have to have manpower, and as anyone knows, in the summer, getting volunteers to do something consistently is just, it's really not sustainable. So, it's costly, and it's always going to be so. But if you ignore the problem, plants don't care when you're arguing about who's going to do it or whose land it's on. They're just growing, reproducing, going to seed, and, you know, finding new habitat. And that's what plants do.
Mm-hmm. And I want to remind our listeners, you can call in if you have a question at 235-7721 or email info@kbbi.org. And you, Janice, you mentioned something kind of interesting as far as Alaska being essentially kind of this last chance to get it right. And you said we're relatively new to battling invasives. Is that just because of our distance from a lot of these issues in the lower 48? Or why do we have small populations of invasive invasive species as of right now?
Distance plays into it. Recognition that there was an issue is fairly new. It's taken a while to have our governing bodies understand and become involved in the partnership to control these, the spread of these. And it really does work into a... it has to be an economic factor. You know, they have to be affecting either agriculture or fisheries or something like that to get that response of money to get things going. It's a sad fact of life. But here, oftentimes people, you know, when I'm going to use orange hawkweed as an example, and that's probably opening up a huge can of worms, but it was always thought of, oh, that pretty little plant that you would find in cemeteries. And the Homer region is your prime example of that. And now the Hickerson Memorial is a solid mat of orange hawkweed because it was planted there. 15 years ago, nobody thought about, oh, maybe we should kill this with some kind of application. And they resisted that, and the plant just completely spread. So now, in order to do anything about it, it would be extremely costly. And because it's not being contained in that area, it's marching down the road, and it is wiping out all those South Slope meadows that huge native plant variety that everybody enjoys. I do think that, you know, it has detriments, and without addressing it in an organized fashion, you know, we're just going to be piecemealing it and not really very successful.
Sure.
I would like to tag on to that real quick before we live off the issue of the economics. It really does come down to an economic issue as far as a threshold or trigger for action. One of the most widely cited studies on invasive species, it's old now, it's 2005, but Pimentel et al. That was done through U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, estimated in 2005 that the annual cost of invasive species to the United States is $120 billion. And that was 12, 13 years ago now. So it really is an economic factor, and it's recognition of that economic impact that triggers action.
Yeah, and we have a caller on line one. Nina, you are on the coffee table, and it sounds like we're getting a little feedback. If you have your radio on in the background, it'd be good to shut off. But go ahead with your question.
Oh, I don't have a radio on in the background. I turned it off. Yes, I do have a question. Over the years, I've been battling invasives, especially the orange hawkweed and the yellow hawkweeds over here at the end of Skyline Drive. But the frustrating part, I've been watching along the roadsides of Skyline, and I've been watching the march of the orange hawkweed towards the end of Skyline and the reed canary grass that's all along the area, too. And it's frustrating because you know that there's not any control being done on the ditches, and so it's just inevitable. It's eventually going to be all over our ditches all the way to the end of the road. And so I'm wondering what kinds of things that are being worked on with DOT to try to get some cooperation in controlling these things. Because as they go past waterways, seeds will probably get into the waterways, and who knows where those seeds will go. So, or even plant parts. So I'm wondering what the solution is on the ditching along the roadways, because it affects private property. I've been working to try to control these things on the Inspiration Ridge Preserve, and it's starting to pop up in all different sorts of places on my property.
Okay, thanks for your question.
Yeah, Nina, that's an excellent question. So as you can probably imagine, all right-of-ways, whether it's roads or trails or power lines or utility lines of any kind, are primary vectors for invasive, whether it's because of hitching rides on wildlife that use those corridors or because it's on contaminated equipment on those corridors. DOT is a partner in this process, and several years ago they introduced a new management program called the Integrated Vegetation Management Program. That it's for all vegetation management along the right-of-ways, but there is a component in there for addressing invasive species. And it talks about what zones, what priorities, and what herbicides can be used. The problem is the mechanism is there, the funding is not necessarily. Right now, through the Soil and Water Conservation District of Homer, we do have a integrated invasive pest program that involves a right-of-way component, and there are a number of sites that we try to treat each year. And so, for example, I believe later today, Jen will be up treating the area around Starisky Creek to treat for bird vetch, and there's actually a number of invasives there. And there's new practice and education coming along, too. The Cooperative Extension Service released a publication a couple of years ago on best management practices within right-of-ways with some very strong recommendations. There's a lot of things to consider, such as the direction that you're mowing when you're mowing along the roadside. If you start in the infestation and you keep moving beyond it, you're spreading the vegetative matter in the seeds, whereas the better practice would be to start where there is no invasives and mow towards the invasives, so at least you're not spreading it. And it's a wonderful publication. It's available online. But there's a lot of things like that that it's still, because invasives are a relatively new phenomenon, and understanding their spread and how it is that we are often involuntarily contributing to the problem, there's things and new tools that we're learning.
Okay, and we actually had another question come in on that topic, but before we get to that, I'm unfamiliar, I'm relatively new to there. What does orange hawkweed do? What is the issue with orange hawkweed? What are the issues that it causes?
Orange hawkweed is a very aggressive competitor, and it reproduces vegetatively. It reproduces by seed. It's an aster, so it's dandelion-like for those that haven't seen it. It's the devil's paintbrush, so it's the only one of that color for those of you who have seen it around town, bright orange. And it basically will turn grass into nothing but hawkweed, and there's not many competitors that can do that. Janice mentioned Hickerson. It's a perfect example. If you want to go up there and look, if you're not paying attention, it looks like it's just a normal lawn or grass, but if you bend down and look, you'll see that the entire vegetated mat is these little fuzzy leaves. It also competes aggressively through allelopathy, which is plants that have the ability to release toxins into the surrounding soil to kill the plants around them. So it's not just competing for the nutrients. it's literally poisoning the plants around it with chemicals in order to reclaim that land as they die back, which is an interesting argument for folks who are a little bit against using chemicals to treat orange hawkweed. Orange hawkweed is using chemicals to treat the plants around it so that it can dominate. And for those who have seen the areas around town when where orange hawkweed gets a foothold, nothing else grows.
Okay, and we had a question from Bob Day who emailed in, and he says he has a bunch of it in his yard, and you kind of indicated as far as mowing, but what are some other things? Bob was wondering what he can do to handle the hawkweed in his yard.
Very important. Don't mow it. So other thing about orange hawkweed, if you mechanically control it at all, if you deadhead it, if you pluck it, if you dig part of it up, it stimulates the plant to grow vegetatively even more aggressively. So if you've been mowing your hawkweed, you're helping it, you're stimulating it. Unfortunately, the only way to get rid of hawkweed, unless you only have a patch that's like a foot by a foot and you can really dig the whole thing out and get down deep and get every chunk of root, the only way to treat it is with herbicide. You need to have a broadleaf selective herbicide. It needs to be applied early in the summer when the basal rosettes are out, but before the plant bolts or just as it bolts. You definitely want to get it before it flowers. And using the right herbicide at the right time under the right conditions are all very important factors. Even people who do use herbicide to try and control these things, I find a lot of time they're using the wrong herbicide, they're using it at the wrong time, and they're applying it under the wrong conditions. So that's why it's really important to reach out to a local conservation district, cooperative extension agent, or a lot of the experts out here that are available to give very detailed specific prescriptions.
And just on the other thing, you can use a tarp over it. So you can cover it with a tarp and then just monitor the edges of that tarp. But you're going to need to leave that tarp in place for about 5 years. And then when you dig it back or when you pull the tarp back, you have to have a plan as to remove that vegetative mat of dead orange hawkweed and plant something else, but continue to monitor the area. This plant is truly a thug.
And you, Jenny, you also had something to add?
I was going to say, if you do have something this year that's already gone, it's aren't gone to flower, you can flag the area so you know where it's at in your yard, and then next year apply herbicide so you know where to look for it. And I think that's going to be something helpful because a lot of times we think about it when it's flowering, but it's not, but the time to apply herbicide, like Matt said, is before it goes to flower. So seeing it, knowing where to look for it is going to be important. And over the, like, kind of like you think of over-the-counter herbicide, you can buy 2,4-D, which is Weed Begone, at Fred Meyer's or Safeway, I think. So something like that. So again, it's like 2,4-D is the chemical, and Weed Begone, it would be the trade name if you actually want a specific chemical.
Okay.
And hey. Also, just one more thing. As a person that has it on your property, please understand that this is not just a one-shot deal. This is going to take you years of control. So you will have to really keep an eye on it and be diligent with your applications, because it is not just put some Weed Begone on it and then forget about it. It will be back.
Okay. And I want to remind listeners, if you have a question about invasives in your own backyard, on public land, on the peninsula, or even in the water, you can call 235-7721 with your question. You can also email info@kbbi.org. And just want to remind those emailing in, please include your name as well, so we know who is asking the question. And, you know, and prior to that question, we were kind of on the topic of, the economic issue. And it seems like a big portion of this is awareness. And I was looking through several of the publications on the Kenai Peninsula cooperative weed management site. And, you know, there was an interesting bell curve that was kind of in relation to public awareness and the difficulty of eradicating something. And you know, an orange hawkweed sounds like a nightmare to get rid of. But, from a larger scale management perspective, how early do we have to notice something before it becomes too hard to get rid of?
Well, I'd like to highlight perhaps something that is a little more uplifting and not thinking, oh, we've lost, it's gloom and doom. A number of years ago along the Anchor River, there was a white sweet clover population that was found. It was dealt with for 2 years, and it's not there anymore. So the sooner that you find something when it is small and doable, you can just hand remove those things. And bingo, problem solved. You just keep your eyes out in that area to scout and make sure that it is not returning. I think that is obviously the best way to approach some of these things. When you see a plant that looks out of place, that you're unsure of what it is, get a good identification on it. Find out its habits and be able to report it. There are many agencies now that are very interested in what is being transported here. So I just think that by making the public, the community at large, aware of, hey, I've never seen this before. What do you think it is? Knowing what your resources are, taking it into Home or Soil and Water, taking a picture of it and posting it on the Cooperative Extension Service has a pest portal and a weed ID thing. And you could do that right from your cell phone, right in the field. I mean, there are a lot of opportunities to learn what is new in the plant world in your community. And for someone like you who's new to the area, it also gives you the opportunity to learn what is native to your area as well.
Yeah, and that's a really good plug right now, I think, would be Gino Graziano with the Cooperative Extension Service out of Anchorage has created a phenomenal app for both iPhone and Android. It's called AK Weeds ID, and it allows you to take a picture of any plant, and it automatically records your GPS coordinates, and you can enter some other information in if you would like to go along with that, and that automatically goes to Gino, and he reviews it and will call locals in that area to go to a site visit if necessary, and that all goes into the state ACEPIC, which is the Alaska Exotic and Invasive Plant Clearinghouse. It's an online mapping portal, kind of like Google Earth, but it's all about just mapping invasives in Alaska. So you can zoom around. You can actually zoom right down in on Homer, and you can look at where infestations have been reported all over town, what year they reported, what the stem count was, all that kind of stuff. And so that data is being collected, and those tools for awareness are out there. The app's a great one, and the Kenai Peninsula Weed website, which is kenaiweeds.org, has a phenomenal amount of resources on there as well for education.
Okay. And, you know, and as far as reporting goes, you know, there were a few resources that were mentioned, but I would assume knowing, depending on what you find, knowing the right place to go, is there kind of a one-stop shop for invasive plants that would be a good place to start as far as reporting something?
For invasives in general, Tammy's numbers, 188 invasives.
Yep.
188 invasives.
1-877 invasive.
1-877 invasive, and that
no
will,
E on the end.
No E on the end, or you could type it, and the phone will just ignore it. But if that's an easy one to remember, and if it's not in Tammy's radar or region, then she is the statewide coordinator that will get that information out to whoever should have it.
And is that just for plants, or is
everything?
No, this is for everything.
Zebra mussels, pike, whatever you see, anything invasive.
Okay, and we have another caller on the line. Ted, you are on the coffee table. Go ahead with your question.
Good morning. How are you doing? I think one of the most invasive species in Alaska that causes the most economic harm is the pusky. I'm sensitive. I get the burns from pusky. And if you let pusky take over your yard, basically it becomes their yard because you can't even go into it. Are there any methods for the homeowner to control it I've examined, you know, repeatedly cutting it. I have a flamethrower, and not to dump on DOT, but one of the things that old homesteaders have told me is that the DOT in the process of maintaining roads actually promoted the growth by spreading the seeds, and they say, I have no experience on this, but they say that there was no pusky before the roads were maintained. And of course, I want the roads to be maintained, but how can we deal with this problem?
All right. Thanks for your question, Ted.
Oh, Ted, let me take that on for you. Pusky can't have that same noxious invasive plant category because it is a native plant found here. And I will say that one of the things that you'll notice how rapidly it has spread along the roadsides is due to the tree removal. When the spruce bark beetle came through and knocked down the forest around here, it opened up all that land. And when people cut down the trees to put in pasture lands, once again, it opened up all of that area to sunshine. Pusky does not tolerate shade. You will not find it growing in shady spots. You'll find it growing in the sun. it's quite possible that things get spread as equipment moves down the road just because that's how the seed is moved. But it's not an intentionally put there plant. It's just a plant that is taking advantage of a new opportunity for its habitat. If you would like to call me at my office this afternoon at 907-262-5824, we can discuss in depth what you can do about pushke in your yard.
Okay, and well, you know, in just in short, what are some basic examples for landowners that are trying to control pushke?
Dress accordingly, because it will burn you. It can be a fairly significant burn, so that means boots, long sleeves, long pants, not on sunny days. I'd even wear a mask, actually, so that you're not inhaling it. You can mow it. You can dig it. There are chemicals that are useful in killing pushke, but do understand that if it's been in an area for a long time, every fall, those beautiful big seed heads drop seed like crazy, and it will keep coming back. So you need to have, once again, that long-term management plan and the ability to stick to it.
Okay, and we have another caller on the line. Finley, you are on the coffee table. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. I want to ask about canary seed grass, the origins and the problems. In what way is it really a problem, and is there so much of it that it's basically hopeless to eliminate it? But as far as origins, I've got a couple interesting points. One of them is that there's a field out East Road next to Tom Maloney's driveway where there's a lot of it, and I understand that the homesteader there was experimenting with different grasses, and I wonder if the early homesteaders brought in canary seed because they thought it would produce a greater crop for feeding their animals. But then a real interesting occurrence of it is on Yukon Island, on the archaeological site, which in the Russian-American period was a Russian outpost. And there's a small patch of it right in the middle of the site, about 15 feet square, totally the canary seed. But it hasn't spread because all the natural beech rye around it are so strong. But I'm wondering, do you think that maybe the Russians brought canary seed over to use for bedding or something? And that's about all, just the canary seed. And why is it a big problem? Thanks.
Hey, thanks for your question.
Awesome. I'd like to take that on, I guess, and there's two parts there. So introduction, it was certainly introduced as intentional forage crop. And the advantage that it has is that it is a late season. So if you're running fields of timothy and brome and you're hoping to get a first and second cutting in the season, if you have a field of reed canary grass, you can get a third cutting even in September. One good way of identifying reed canary grass, if you're uncertain in your area, is once all of the native Kelmogrostis and other grasses have died back and gone yellow, it's the last green grass standing. As far as its compromising of and what it causes problems for, it compromises salmon habitat along streams. So reed canary grass essentially in a field isn't necessarily causing substantial economic harm other than it's a petri dish creating seeds that can be transported to other places. When it gets into a stream, and the Watershed Forum actually has a wonderful publication that was created by Edgar Orjuela, who is no longer with them, but it illustrates how this reed canary grass grows out into the stream bank, right into the spawning zone, and then it grows out from there, and then it grows out from there, and then it grows out from there. And over time, especially places historically that we've known reed canary grass has been for a while, you can see this. The river turns into a creek, turns into a stream, and you just lose more and more and more salmon spawning habitat. The salmon like the banks as opposed to the center of the river, and they're losing that real estate to the reed canary grass. So it's a salmon resource.
Okay, and we also have another caller on line three. Dave, go ahead. You are on the coffee table.
Hi, good morning. Dave here in Homer. I wanted to talk for a minute about spotted knapweed. I've been looking at the sheet that's available from the Forest Service online. It was out a few years ago at the end of the spit at the landing craft dock, and there was an outbreak there. There were maybe 30 or 40 plants out there, and I removed them because I know what a Bane spotted knapweed is. My assumption is somebody brought some hay down and stuck it there and were taking it across the bay, and the seeds abandoned the bales at that point. But I've seen knapweed across the plain states and through the Midwest, and I know that It's a nasty European or from the probably from the steppes of Eurasia there, and it can be a real pain. So maybe you could talk about knapweed, and also especially for our friends that are using hay, moving it around to make sure that they keep an eye out for it.
All right, thanks for your question.
Spotted knapweed has been found a couple of times in Alaska in various locations, and it has been really well managed. I'm glad that you took the initiative to do something about it when you found it. Here on the peninsula, there's only just been one other site that I'm aware of that it has been found. And so it's really important that we learn the lessons from those other states that you mentioned and not let it run amok. There is a program, too, that people could consider. When you're looking to buy hay or straw, there's a certified weed-free program wherein those fields are inspected prior to cutting so that any of those nasty weeds that might be in there don't get shipped around the state. That's a voluntary program from hay producers, and it's one that, you know, people could contact their local soil and water conservation districts to sign up for, and it certainly does help us a lot because, you know, nobody's trying to do this maliciously. It's just unintentional movement, and seeds don't respect that movement. So,
yeah, and oh, sorry, go ahead, Matt. You had something.
Well, I was going to say, so I have not observed the knapweed around the Homer area, but what I do see quite a bit of, and it's raising some eyebrows, is a very close relative, and I'm kind of forgetting what the over-the-counter names commonly are, but it's so spotted knapweed is a Centaurea bieberstinii.
Yeah.
And a close relative is Centaurea montana.
Garden plant.
It's a very common ornamental. It has not demonstrated the devastating invasive impacts ecologically that the spotted knapweed has, but it has shown the ability in the southern peninsula on the south side of the bay and here in Homer to escape captivity. And you'll see it around Homer quite a bit. It's a very beautiful plant. Looks a lot like spotted knapweed. It's a little more purple than pinkish. And that's a good thing, too, is that there is not a good thing, but an interesting thing to point out is false positives. There are a lot of plants that look really similar. So we have like our native GMs here in Homer and buttercups, but then we have our invasive buttercups like KBBI has lined in their wonderful ditch out in front of the studios here. And very similar, hard to tell them apart unless you know what to look for.
Okay, yeah, and you mentioned the app for IDing some plants earlier in the show, but I also wanted to touch on something else. You mentioned some, and as far as invasives, you were saying, you know, it's not malicious, people aren't intentionally planting, but there are some garden variety of invasives that are planted, and I've seen guides online as far as saying, you know, what to avoid planting. What are some of the common garden variety plants that people might unknowingly plant that are invasive?
Wow, I'd like to start with the loosestrife. Loosestrife was found, and it still is grown in several gardens in Anchorage and perhaps here. It has the ability to escape and really just destroy wetlands. It's a real pretty plant. Looks a lot like fireweed, but blooms a lot later. A lot of folks, Extension Look has a pub that says, don't plant a problem. This talks about a lot of the campanulas that are really aggressive spreaders, hard to get rid of. You know, the things that you see along the side of the road, which is an oxeye daisy as opposed to a Shasta daisy, they have an invasive ranking to them. Instead of reed canary grass, there's a variegated variety that is used in garden plants, and it likes to spread rhizomatously underground, and it can be very difficult to get rid of. And everybody's should be well aware of what we call elephant bamboo or Japanese knotweed, which is a beautiful plant and will be so impossible to get rid of once established. It would be detrimental to the community. It's very prevalent in southeast Alaska now, and it was purposely planted as an ornamental, but once it escapes that cultivation, it's like a nightmare waiting to happen.
Okay.
I can add, you know, some of the more common ones around here that we see is common tansy, which is another pretty, somewhat fragrant plant that does easily escape cultivation. And its primary impacts are that it does upset pollinator habits, as any flowering plant's going to be that's not part of the native ecosystem. But it's also toxic to grazing animals. And so a moose wouldn't necessarily eat a tansy if it saw it. But as I've witnessed, for example, over in Seldovia, where it spreads into the tree line and it's growing up in the willow browse. And so it does have a toxin that can be ingested by wild animals. Another one you see in Homer a lot is what we call butter and eggs, which is the Linaria vulgaris. I don't think there's a flower bed in Homer that doesn't have it, whether it's supposed to be there or not. That's another common one that was introduced ornamentally and has escaped.
Okay. And Jen, actually, I wanted to, in particular, as far as what are some of the invasives? We've talked a little bit about reed canary grass, damaging salmon habitat, but are there other invasives out there that we should be keeping an eye out for as far as salmon habitat is concerned?
Well, and this kind of goes back to another point. So Elodia, we think that it might have a huge impact on salmon habitat as far as the economic cost. There was a paper that was released by Toby Shore, and he said about $500,000 maximum it could cost the state per year as far as damages to our salmon industry. So that's a lot of economic impact. Other things to look out for is Brazilian Elodia, Hydrilla. There's a couple other weeds. Luckily, just because, like we had mentioned before, there is a good amount of distance between Alaska and other states, it would take a lot to travel, but it is possible as a vector.
Okay. And is that something that it would be found in streams, lakes, or where?
Lakes, yeah. So other areas of the United States have a huge problem with it. The idea is, though, clean, drain, dry. If you are having a vessel from the lower 48 come up here, that's kind of the mantra, I think, for aquatic invasives, is to clean any boats as well as waders. The Kenai Peninsula did a really great thing as far as the felt sole waders. We saw that the felt sole was, taking algae from one area and transporting it to another area. And so that was the possibility of that. And so with not having felt sole waders, since they're hard to clean, it reduces the risk of spread of some aquatic invasives. There's just a couple of practices like that. So cleaning your equipment, whether it's boats or waders or other equipment that's used in the water bodies.
Okay. And you mentioned zebra mussels, and we've talked a little bit about Elodia. What are some of the other aquatic invasives that we're dealing with on the peninsula?
We don't actually have zebra mussels on the Kenai Peninsula, thankfully. Okay. So that's great. As far as aquatic invasives, we're pretty low. So we have the northern pike. That's the issue. Right now it's contained to really the Tote Road area, right outside Soldotna. The ADF&G did a really great job of kind of taking care of the pockets of northern pike that were there in the previous 5 years or so. And then as far as the other ones, Elodia is the main one, and reed canary grass are the main issues that we're seeing.
Okay.
I could add one more that's popped up here on the Southern Kenai Peninsula. In Kodiak is the signal crayfish, which has started appearing in Anadromous streams. And Kodiak is the only location I know of so far. So that's something that they're keeping an eye on. The Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District and Blythe down there have some active programs going on where they're getting lots of volunteers out there trying to catch as many as possible and decrease the population, and at the same time get a handle on just how big the population is. And we believe those were intentionally introduced.
Okay. And, in going to northern pike, they are native to some portions of Alaska. What makes them invasive in this portion?
So, and let's say Bristol Bay, for example, where they do have northern pike and salmon coexist. Salmon really are spawning in deeper areas in Bristol Bay, so their habitat is deeper, whereas northern pike are at shallower areas. So there's a distinct line of habitat. We don't see the northern pike going into the deeper areas, deeper waters, versus here on the Kenai Peninsula, most of our waters are shallow. So when there is overlap, they're overlapping their habitat, and then the northern pike decimate. I mean, we see it decimating very, very quickly as population of salmon. We saw that in the Mackay Lakes where northern pike were introduced, and then in a decade, there's no more salmon in those areas. So it can happen really quickly. Northern pike are these apex predators. They really know how to target little salmon juvenile fish. And eventually, as northern pike are great, I think anglers love to fish for them, especially when they're from the northern states like Minnesota. They put up a good fight. Unfortunately, after they kind of decimate the salmon population, they start to feed on each other, and they get smaller and smaller and smaller as they're kind of cannibalizing themselves.
Okay, and we have just about 10 minutes left here, so if you're a listener that has a question, you can call in at 235-7721. You can also email info@kbbi.org. Please include your name with your question. And, you know, and before I do want to touch on some techniques landowners can use in their own personal land, but are there invasives out there that have not arrived here that were, you know, that people are on alert for? I'm thinking of like European green crab, things that are being actively monitored for.
Yeah, and actually, I'm glad you brought the green crab up, because that's a good opportunity to mention the work that's being done by Rosie Robinson and some of her staff at the Ketchikan Bay Natural Estuarine Research Reserve. There's a volunteer program in place for monitoring European green crab, and me and my family participate on it. And there's a number of locations around Ketchikan Bay that do, and essentially consists of, at a really low tide, putting a series of pots and traps out, anchored to the beach, let the tide come in, go out again. And then I love doing it with my kids, because they have a blast going down. You identify all the species that are in there, you measure them, you take water temperatures, salinity, all that kind of stuff. So there's an active monitoring program in place, and the whole impetus behind that would be that early detection, rapid response. As soon as it shows up, you know, we need to know. So green crab is one. It's moving its way up British Columbia. I forget how far north it's gone. Every year it gets a little bit farther north. Should it get here, as many listeners know, the shellfish population in Ketchikan Bay is already in a state of sad disrepair and instability. And the last thing we need is a voracious predator like the green crab to show up. And so that's an example of one that is not here. I say yet. I wish I didn't have to. And there's plenty of people who are trying to keep their eyes open and ears to the ground.
Are there invasives?
I would like to highlight a slug that was found in Seward last year. It's a Limus maximus. It is a leopard slug, can get to be about 10 inches in length. First time it's ever been found in South Central Alaska was last fall in Seward. It was sent off to malacologists and identified. This is something people really need to look out for. Our native slugs already consume enough of our stuff without having a new player in town. At the end of the season, 23 slugs had been trapped in Seward, and so that probably means that the population can establish. So really keep an eye out. Look up leopard slug. There's a reporting place to report it, should you find it at that 1-877-INVASIVE.
Okay, and we have a caller on line one. Kathy, you are on the coffee table. Go ahead with your question.
Thanks, guys, for doing all of this morning. You said earlier that white clover was considered an invasive, and I just wondered the why. And the second question was Mayday trees. Are they still considered invasive, and why? Thanks.
Hardy, thank you.
So white clover, we should specify white sweet clover, which is unique as opposed to like the alsike clover, which we see around town in common ground cover and yard mixes and along the roadside. Sweet clover is tall. It gets up over 6 feet tall. It is extremely pungent, actually not displeasant.
No.
One of the primary things that it interrupts is the local pollinator cycles, which is something, again, that's a ecological cycle locally that already is somewhat compromised and does not need more challenges. Because of that pungent aroma and because of how much it produces, it really offsets the pollinator cycles. And each plant can produce 300 and some thousand seeds, a crazy amount. And the seeds have a soil viability life of, longest it's been recorded is 81 years. So it's a problem that does not go away once it gets here, unless you get really aggressive. And then the Mayday tree. Problem with the Mayday tree is that, again, it's a toxicity issue. And they are very pretty, but there is a relative, it's a cyanide relative derivative chemical that's in them. And at greater concentrations during different parts of the year, specifically the winter. We had a winter several years ago in Anchorage where I believe there was a number of moose that died, and it was determined that all of them died from munching on Mayday trees. Again, this is something moose wouldn't intentionally target and hunt these down, but if, especially in an urban area like Anchorage, where there may not be a lot of sufficient willow browse, or you have the Mayday mixed in with it, they will end up eating it, and it can be very highly toxic.
That, and it's the berries are eaten by birds, and so it passes through their digestive system and gets planted in a lot of different areas. In creeks and streams in interior Alaska, by Fairbanks, and then in Anchorage as well, it's found to almost start dominating the understory of all these little streams, and that changes fish habitat and everything else just by those real pretty trees that we like.
All right. And Jen, you had something to add?
I say white sweet clover also has a toxicity issue. So it was originally planted as a forage crop, but we saw that it was causing blood thinning issues. So it's a blood thinner. So that's also something to raise concern as far as our native flora.
Okay. And, you know, I wanted to end the show on, we touched on it a little bit, but as far as what can private landowners do, I think one, to make their property more resilient, to prevent invasives from coming in the first place, and then what are some things they can do to find resources for invasives they find, and to eventually help get rid of them?
Wow, that's a lot of questions to wind up on. I do think that property owners really need to understand that they are responsible for the maintenance of their landscapes. So if they find a small population of something, deal with it immediately. Find out what the correct control methods that are available to them are, and then act on it. A lot of times, and I'm not pointing fingers at anyone, but we as humans want to wait for somebody to come and fix things for us. And at this stage, and as taxpayers, that doesn't exist in our state right now. There is no funding for people to come out and to spray your orange hawkweed. So you need to take that ownership yourself, learn how to use the products, learn how to recognize the plants, and take care of it on your own. Band together with your neighbors. Instead of forming a neighborhood watch, form a neighborhood weed watch. Contact the DOT. Tell them that this is important to you and that you would like them to adopt better management practices. We have the ability, but we need to act. We can't just figure that somebody else is going to do it for us. There's many tools available in this community for how do you control things, how you recognize things, where to go to find these products that can be used. So take ownership. Stand up. It's your land. Take care of it.
And there is a program, though, that landowners can access, correct, Matt?
Yes. Through the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District right now, we have a project through cooperation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Partners Program. And it is... it has changed a little bit in scope, but essentially applications can be made through the Soil and Water Conservation District. And for people in the Upper Peninsula, they can contact Jen at the Watershed Forum as a representative for this program. And it is targeted, though, for higher priority invasives. And so orange hawkweed would probably not get funded, but if somebody had reed canary grass and they had an anadromous stream in their property, that may get funded. If there was obviously something like sweet clover or Japanese knotweed or some of the higher priority ones, then there are resources and funding and staff available to come in and help that private property owner address the problem. At any given time, for a lot of us, I know Janice, Jen, and me, even if someone just has a question and needs a recommendation, just having that IPM, that integrated pest management plan to begin with, we can go and visit a landowner, just spend a half hour walking around and saying, make sure you do this, don't ever do that, and here's what's important, and, you know, call me at this time, we'll follow up.
Okay. And it's about all the time we have. And in the studio today, we had Matt Steffi with the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, Jen Hester with the Kenai Watershed Forum, and Janice Chumley with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service. Thanks for joining me, guys. And Jesse Thorne, Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is coming up next.